It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the Alzheimer's Association, an estimated 5.8 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's disease. That number includes approximately 200,000 individuals under age 65 who have younger onset Alzheimer's. Dr. Arthur Levine is the longtime dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and senior vice chancellor for health sciences at the University of Pittsburgh. He will soon be stepping down to start a new lab to research Alzheimer's. Dr. Levine joins us in studio this morning. Welcome to the Confluence, sir.
Thank you, Kevin.
The research lab, I understand, will be within the Brain Institute at the university. Is that correct?
I will have my own personal lab, but more importantly, we are starting a new center, an Alzheimer's disease basic research center, also within the Brain Institute.
Okay. So there's already been research at the University of Pittsburgh regarding Alzheimer's. Will this lab, this new center, take it in a different direction, a more concentrated focus? What's your intent?
The intent is, in fact, to try to illuminate the molecular root causes of Alzheimer's disease, because my colleagues and I believe that this probably is not a curable disease, but one which should be prevented. And our focus then will be first hoping to illuminate the molecular root causes of Alzheimer's disease, and then hoping that we can identify a drug or an antibody or a vaccine that would prevent the disease altogether. To do that, we have to be aware that this disease probably starts 15 to 20 years before a patient develops their first symptoms. So that will lead us then to try to go back in time, understand what triggers the disease, and at that point, screen appropriately for drugs or vaccines that may be preventative.
15 to 20 years before the symptoms present themselves. So would the screening in your mind have to be part of, you know, a regular checkup for individuals so that it can be spotted that far in advance?
It certainly could be, but our hope is to identify those people who are susceptible to the disease, and that may relate to their particular genetics. Mm-hmm. We don't know that yet, but another goal of our intensive research with this new focus is to try to identify those people at the level of their DNA who may be susceptible to the disease as they age.
I want to follow up on the question about research that's already been done. What is the role of, I believe you mentioned, beta amyloids, and is it too late by the time you spot those?
I think it probably is. The only breakthrough that we've had in Alzheimer's research since Alzheimer gave it its name was here at the University of Pittsburgh, when two of my colleagues, Drs. Klunk and Mathis, after 20 years of research, developed a compound that can be injected intravenously, goes to the brain, and binds selectively and specifically to beta amyloid. Beta amyloid is a misfolded protein that appears to be the trigger of the disease. We're not sure yet whether it is truly the cause or whether it itself is a compensatory mechanism. But whatever it is, it does seem to be first in line in the disease. But when it's already present, it has apparently set off a cascade of other activities, molecular entities within brain cells that ultimately lead to neurodegeneration.
You said just a moment ago, don't look at as a curable disease at this point, but focusing on prevention. What about treatment? Is there going to be any focus on that treatment of maybe slowing the progression?
There certainly could be, and we are not going to give up on that possibility. But all the evidence so far is that at best, we might delay the disease a little bit, we might slow it a little bit, but ultimately, as with many diseases, it will be far more effective and efficient to prevent the disease than to treat it after the fact. Just as we in Pittsburgh learned how to prevent polio with the Salk vaccine, than to put children in iron lungs.
Mm-hmm. You are a physician, a scientist, a researcher. If you can get one answer from the research that you and your team will be involved in, what would you want it to be?
Well, the answer would be, first of all, as I said, to identify the root cause of the disease, and then hopefully to identify a way to prevent that cause from unfolding.
Right. Do we know why the numbers of people with Alzheimer's continue to grow? Is it a factor of people are living longer? Maybe the medical community, medical researchers have had success in dealing with other diseases, whether it's heart disease, whether it's cancer. So people are living longer than maybe more likely or to develop Alzheimer's?
I don't think there's any question that we're living longer. Historically, our lifespan was perhaps 30 years. Mm-hmm. Later, perhaps 50 years, but now it is not at all uncommon for people to live well into their 80s. Mm-hmm. And so the longer we live, the more damage our cells incur. For example, we know that our DNA becomes more fragile, more readily damaged, including the DNA in our neurons, our brain cells. We know that the immune system may vary in its function, perhaps more weakly as we age. And obviously, the longer we live, the more our bodies are subjected to any number of environmental activities that may compromise the viability and function of our brain cells.
According to the Alzheimer's Association, more women get Alzheimer's than men. Do you accept that? And is it because women tend to live longer than men?
I think that's probably the reason. I think women live longer than men. There are many more women living in their 80s and 90s than men. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that this is a gender-specific disease. We have no evidence for that.
Is there a racial component? That same data from the Alzheimer's Association indicated twice as many older African Americans have Alzheimer's than older white Americans.
Mm-hmm. That may well be, but I think there it's important to recognize that our longevity and our health is dependent upon social determinants of health and environmental determinants of health and individual behavior, probably in the aggregate more so than our DNA, and probably much more so than our interactions with doctors and hospitals. Mm-hmm. That being the case, we have to respect the fact that African Americans may have had disadvantages socially and environmentally that whites haven't had on average.
So if the African-American senior and the white senior lived in the same environment, had the same lifestyle, that wouldn't necessarily be the case of being more susceptible to Alzheimer's.
As far as we know, that's correct. But we haven't, that has never been analyzed at scale.
So I want to get to, do we know, what do you want to know? Why do some people develop Alzheimer's and others not? Because there are plenty of people in their 80s and 90s that do not have any form of dementia.
I think that's a very good question and an insightful one, Kevin. There is a rare form of Alzheimer's disease called familial heritable Alzheimer's disease. It begins in the 30s and has about a 12-year course. Most patients with this rare and awful variant die by the time they're in their early 40s. Mm. And we know that they have mutations. We understand where those mutations are. And so that leads me to believe that although we don't yet know with any certainty what genetic aberrations might occur in the common form of Alzheimer's, the age-dependent form of Alzheimer's, that will certainly be something that we will be looking at very intensely. If we can identify genetic susceptibility to Alzheimer's, then we will know exactly when we have to go back 15 to 20 years see whether a given patient has that anomaly or not and prevent it at that point in time.
We have just about 30 seconds left. You're involved with the Human Million Genome Project. Do you expect maybe that information, that research might help you in Alzheimer's research?
Absolutely. We are one of four national centers for the Million Human Genome Project. That project involves our listeners going to one of our many clinics or pop-up places, being weighed and measured and giving a little bit of blood and urine and telling us in a survey about their life history, their behavior, their social environment, so we can put all that together. If they wish to do that, I would urge your listeners to go to joinallofuspa.org or to call 412-383-2737 and enroll in this critical study.
Dr. Arthur Levine, thanks so much for joining us. And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the final Three Rivers train runs from Chicago to Pittsburgh in 2005. The daily Amtrak line served passengers traveling from New York to Chicago and many stops in between for nearly a decade. The entire trip took about 20 hours and passed through the Allegheny Mountains and along the Horseshoe Curve near Altoona, PA. It was discontinued in 2005 due to low ridership and a cancellation of a U.S. Postal Service contract. Now, the Pennsylvanian train takes passengers from New York to Pittsburgh. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Former Navy officer Pam Iovino is the Democrat running in the April 2nd special election for the 37th state Senate district to succeed Guy Reschenthaler. He was elected to Congress in November. The district includes Pittsburgh suburbs ranging from the airport area to the South Hills. We spoke with businessman and Republican nominee Dee Raja about his campaign last week. Today, Iovino tells 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter that her work representing military interests in Congress has helped prepare her for Harrisburg.
I have worked in the legislative branch, both with the Navy and then at the Department of Veterans Affairs. My experience in legislative government has always been bipartisan. It's about getting work accomplished and done. One of the reasons that I decided to run for elected office is that I am living in a place that I grew up in that does not look the same in terms of providing the same opportunities that I felt that I had. And I see that having eroded.
What do you think's eroded it?
When a student in Pennsylvania can go to an out-of-state public university cheaper than they can go to one of our universities, I'd say there's work to be done there. If we take advantage of every revenue stream that is available to us, we look at finding better ways to fund all of these things that we want.
A lot of talk on amongst Democrats in particular about establishing a fair funding formula for public education in the schools. And I'm always sort of interested when a candidate is running in the kind of district you're running in, which is broadly suburban, some very prosperous suburban districts out there, how you would sort of deliver that social goal while also reassuring voters, parents, families who are very happy with the status quo because it's working for them. How do you balance those two goals?
I think part of the fair funding issue revolves around that an inordinate amount of the formula comes from real estate property taxes. So that's where we're talking about fairness. I think I'm most aligned with the governor on this one in terms of where it comes from, and that it could come from a reasonable severance tax on the gas and oil industry.
I'm so glad you brought up the severance tax. This issue of natural gas seems to be a very strong point of contrast between the two of you. Raja's belief is that a severance tax will hinder the growth of this industry, damage the prospects, not just for gas, but for all these kind of downstream industries. I'm sure you've heard that concern before. What do you say to people who say, we don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs?
This natural resource that is below our feet and here in this region, the gas and oil industry should not be scared away and would not be scared away. I do not believe that that would happen. So I don't think the premise of the scare is accurate. We need revenue streams to pay for all of the things that our state government provides for us. And so to leave this on the table does not make sense to me to do that.
Speaking of this whole severance issue, there is this ad out from the Raja campaign, and it features a photograph of you alongside Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the U.S. House, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democratic Socialists, and it says, Pam Iovino has teamed up with extremists who want to stop our growth with billions in new energy taxes. What's your kind of reaction to that message and to being linked with these sort of national level Democrats, including a couple of whom are Democratic Socialists?
Well, it probably will come to no surprise to you that I do not know any of those individuals, nor are they supporting me, nor have I sought their support. I don't know what to make of the ad. It is not conveying anything that's accurate about myself, other than that I am a Democrat.
Contrary-wise, your campaign has put out its own ad. The ad basically suggests that Raja's software consulting business had run afoul of Labor Department rules about paying overtime and minimum wage, and that he had sued about 80-odd of his own employees. Why was it important for you to put that stuff out there?
They're facts. They are examples of business practices of my opponent.
The bulk of those complaints really date back to 10 years or more. The Department of Labor complaints date back to early, I think, 2001, 2002. Doesn't that kind of mitigate the importance of that?
I don't know that a timeline or distance from instances matters one way or the other. I think they point to one's integrity in business.
Pam Iovino, thank you so much for being here. Good luck on April 2nd.
Thank you for having me.
That's WESA's politics and government editor, Chris Potter. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Abby Mendelsohn is a journalist and author who's written novels, short stories, and many Pittsburgh-related books, including the official history of the Steelers. He teamed with Pittsburgh-based photographer David Ashkenaz, who travels the world taking photos for editorial, advertising, and corporate clients. Their goal? To capture the contemporary artists who comprise the 21st century Pittsburgh jazz community. Their new book, Spirit to Spirit, A Portrait of Pittsburgh Jazz in the New Century, will be published later this year. They recently joined with David Wachter, the book's designer, to talk with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker about the motivation for and process of putting the book together.
I wanted to start by saying how much I appreciate that this subject has been given this attention. And Abby, let's start with you. What is it that made you think there needs to be a book like this?
First of all, I want to say that it's been a collaborative effort for the three of us. But the thing that drove us is that we love the music. David Wachter loves design. David Ashkenaz loves photography. He's a great photographer of musicians. And I love to write. And we love the music. And we said, wow, you know, let's go for it. We felt so privileged and so honored to be part of these guys' lives for a bit and to go ahead and use our art to celebrate their art.
And David Wachter, when you put the book together, were you influenced by the fact that it was a Pittsburgh book, that this is something about this town and the things that happen in this town?
Yes, very much. I could instantly feel the love and the passion and the devotion that these two guys, long before I got involved, put into it. Abby spent many, many years. Then David spent many, many years. And I did not come to the project until 2 years ago. But it was quickly evident how much heart and soul and work and genius. And I'm still discovering it.
How did you guys figure out who to interview and then who to include in the book? Because I'm sure you interviewed a whole lot more people and photographed a lot more people than ultimately made it into the book.
Yeah, that's correct. I started with an old friend of mine. I started talking with Marty Ashby from Manchester.
Sure.
And I said, Marty, I really want to do this. Who should I include? And we had a list of folks. Unfortunately, some of them have passed away before we could get to them or before we could put them in the book. And as we were on the road looking at artist X or Y or Z, there were other people involved, and we found ourselves saying, gosh, we have to have this person or that person in the book. They are representative of something as part of the larger jazz scene here. And it was toward the end, it was a little bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know, enough with the water. Stop with the water, please, because we decided we were not going to have a high school yearbook. We were not going to have an encyclopedia. We just had to say, okay, these are the folks that we've included. We mean no offense to anybody else, but we had to stop because there's so much talent out there and so many great guys. So we tried to make it organic and then call a halt to it.
David Wachter, you wanted to weigh in on that.
This is not seen from afar by any means. It took me a year and a half before I finally got into the book and began reading and designing. David's photographs are at once beautiful, and you can see that, but it took me a long time. And as I begin to design, I begin to discover what Abby has done, and it is so close to the heart and so close to the bone. There's something incredibly magical about it's poetry. It has the essence of jazz. His prose is almost sometimes like beat, and that may be a mischaracterization, but it's long copy, but it is beautiful long copy. And paired with David's images, a year and a half later, I became really excited for what was laying in front of me.
Abby, were you influenced as you wrote the prose for the book by the photographs that David took?
Yes and no. We spent a lot of time together out on the road. I would watch him shoot. There were many times where I could see that he was shooting exactly what I was describing. Afterward, we would talk about it. I saw early drafts of a number of the photos, and I felt that the way he was capturing the action is the way that I had to capture the action of the live performances. And so there was, in my mind at least, a lot of give and take to that. Other parts of it, I think David Wachter is right. I tried to match the prose to the rhythms of the jazz itself in many cases. And in other cases, there was some fairly straightforward interview stuff that I said, okay, it just has to be more or less reportage. So it was a little of this and a little of that. At the risk of overstating it, I tried to make the prose like jazz itself because it's going to change direction, it's going to change course, it's going to have this voice and that voice all in one piece.
An improvisational nature to it.
Exactly right.
It is very
and
much.
And I thought when I started to read what Abby wrote that it sounded like, in words, what John Coltrane would play in music. It was just a pleasure to read the imagery that he evoked, and it just in a couple of instances, I remember, I think it was Javon Rushton when I showed him a photograph that I did, and Javon has this look on his face like he's a warrior going into battle.
Javon Rushton is a drummer.
And I said something like that, and Abby said, that's exactly what I wrote, that he attacks the drums just like he's, going into a fight or to fight a lion or something.
He is a big guy. He's about 6'5", 6'6".
Right.
And,
But we, not having talked about this before, we were just on exactly the same page, just on the way we responded to the visual and to hearing the music.
How were you guys influenced by the rich legacy and history of jazz in Pittsburgh as you approached this project? Were you at all, or did you try to disassociate yourself from that so that it would be, in fact, a contemporary portrait?
I am not close to it. I find myself drawn to the local jazz community more now that I am immersed in this project, but I was not part of it. It would be wrong to claim otherwise. This book has drawn me in. What I am drawn to is design and great prose and great photography, which is what brought me to these guys. And it's been an awakening for me. It's been a very exciting thing to watch it happen.
I've always felt a debt, always as long as I can remember, from the time I was, no exaggeration, 6, 7, 8 years old, to history. And so I felt that I owed something to, we all did, but I owed something to the rich jazz history here and, of course, to the current jazz community when I wrote about it. Not that my prose is deathless, but books have a way of sitting for a very long time in people's collections and people's hearts and libraries. And I felt that I needed to represent everything that I could with this. While the focus of the book is the contemporary jazz scene, again, the richness of the past and the dignity of all of these artists affected my work very much so.
What is it you want people to take away from the book when they put it down after having looked at the pictures, read the prose? What do you want people to take away?
I have funny mixed feelings. Part of me is such a celebration, the music's so great, and part of me really sort of mourns the fact that, you know, there are virtually no jazz clubs left in the city. They come and go very quickly. There's certainly a jazz community, but I think the greater Pittsburgh community doesn't really support that.
Yeah, I think it's sadder for me and everyone else. I think the jazz community, from what I read and see, is fine and vital and thriving. The other thing that I wanted to say, and without the book here to share, the only people, the three of us, know that how big this thing is. It's 312 pages. It is a massive, visceral, emotional deep dive into this community. Without being encyclopedic, it's an incredible effort.
The takeaway, I think, for folks, we love these guys, we love the music, and we tried to transfer some of that into words and to pictures, and we just hope it spreads the message.
And I'll circle back at this point just to ask for a little more talk about the Pittsburgh aspect, the fact that this is an inherently Pittsburgh project. While jazz exists in literally in every great city around the world, you will find a presence of jazz, and you will find people in those cities within the jazz communities who are aware of Pittsburgh's jazz story. Mm-hmm. But as you put this together, how driven were you, again, by the fact that this is a very Pittsburgh story?
Well, I have a neat anecdote. There's a particular artist whose name I will not mention, but I wanted that artist in the book. The artist is a native Pittsburgher and a personal friend, but the artist has relocated and performs here a couple of times a year. And I had done interviews. I had listened to CDs. I had watched performances. I had notes on top of notes. And David Ashkenaz kicked the artist out of the book because the artist was not sufficiently loyal to Pittsburgh. So part of the idea was that these are people who are here now. Again, in our snapshot of the couple of years we were on the road with this, they are here now. They want to be here. They are part of building and maintaining a community here. They are very cognizant, all of them, of the rich tradition here, but they're here. And that was very important to us, that there's a community building effort on the part of all of these artists.
It was interesting also, many of them, once they sort of got their chops and maybe, you know, got to a point where they could really play, virtually all of them went to New York. You know, it was like the Mecca, like, we have to go to New York.
We go where the money is.
We go see if we can make it there. And many of them, after a couple of years in New York or being on the road and traveling nationally and internationally, all sort of figured out that, you know, Pittsburgh's not so bad. Let's go back there and play, because this sort of New York grind isn't really making it for me.
And plenty of local artists actually tour the world from Pittsburgh.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
You don't need to live in New York to be an international presence in jazz.
George Hyde III, I interviewed him, I think, a week or two after he had just spent like 3 months playing in China.
I think he was there for about 6 or 7 months, yeah.
Yeah.
With a handful of other Pittsburghers,
right,
going to and from China during, right, his tenure there.
Yeah. Right. And I think Paul Cosentino had just come back from taking his band, the Boilermakers, to Korea. So yeah. There's an anecdote in the book of Dwayne Dolphin in Paris. So our guys are all over the world, but this is their place.
Yeah. And what you said a moment ago, Abby, it'll become apparent, I think, when the book is out, is that this is a real-time live snapshot of the city. People say to me, oh, you're doing a book on Pittsburgh Jazz, is Earl Gardner. And people mention George Benson, and people, and I said, no. This is a living tribute to people who are here now doing it. And there's a special energy to that.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker talking with Abby Mendelson, David Ashkenaz, and David Wachter, the team behind a new book called Spirit to Spirit, A Portrait of Pittsburgh Jazz in the New Century. It'll be published later this year. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Nena Cherry. Growing up in her native Sweden, Nena Cherry was exposed to music at an early age. Her stepfather was jazz trumpeter Don Cherry. Her big break came in 1989 with the release of her debut album, Raw Like Sushi, and its smash hit, Buffalo Stance.
We always hang in a buffalo stance. We do the dive at the time we dance.
She released two albums in the 1990s, and one of them featured her global hit, 7 Seconds, a duet with Senegalese musician Youssou N'Dour.
It's not a second, we're 7 seconds away.
She took more than a decade off before recording any more albums, but in the interim, remained busy caring for her family and collaborating with artists like Massive Attack, The Judds, Pulp, Gorillaz, and Lenny Kravitz. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the past year and a half or so, we've come to learn or revisit the story behind the controversial Stephen Foster statue that stood for more than a century before its removal last April. The house where Foster was born also has a fascinating story. Mark Hauser is a storyteller. He writes a monthly column for Pittsburgh Magazine, and he's the director of news information at Robert Morris University. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Stephen Foster's father bought a large parcel of land east of the city and named it Lawrenceville after a War of 1812 Navy captain. So where exactly was the Foster house?
Well, the Foster house was located along what was then the Turnpike to Philadelphia, which is now Penn Avenue.
All right.
He was a pretty wealthy man and speculated on that land, sold the land to the government that became Allegheny Arsenal, but some of his business deals went wrong. And so this pretty cottage, a little white cottage where Stephen Foster was born right there at 3600, he defaulted on the mortgage to it. And by the time Stephen Foster was a one-year-old, the family had to move out. So he never really got to grow up there.
There was actually a big birthday party outside of the house on the day that Foster was born, but it wasn't his birthday party, I guess.
No. It was the 50th birthday of the United States. So he was born on the 4th of July, 1826.
Very good.
Is that right?
Your math is good.
I had to do the math.
Okay. Mark, readers of your columns know that you write about the stories behind some of Pittsburgh's skyscrapers. In addition to the Foster birthplace, Thursday evening at the Landmarks Preservation Resource Center, you'll be talking about the Gulf Tower. Well, you know, I guess a lot of people, they hear Gulf Tower, they'll know about it. They'll think about the color-coded weather beacon on that building downtown. What should we know that most of us don't know about the Gulf building?
The Gulf Tower story is a particularly interesting one because it shows sort of a really dramatic turn right in the midst of its construction. So the person behind it is Andrew Mellon, wealthy Pittsburgh banker. And in the 1920s, when this building was first announced, Mellon was having the best decade of his life, arguably. I mean, he just had the new Mellon Bank open downtown, this temple of, what do they call it, the Cathedral of Earning, some people. he had the Coppers Building had just gone up, and that's a really exciting, you know, art deco construction project going on in Pittsburgh. And then they announce the Gulf building. Now, he's a major investor in each of these companies, Coppers and Gulf. He's also been the Secretary of the Treasury under three presidents through the 1920s. I mean, he's recognized as this brilliant financier. And so the Gulf building starts to be constructed in the late 1920s.
And he intends to make this the tallest building in the city, right?
Yes, it will be the tallest building in Pittsburgh. And then suddenly something happens in 1929 that sort of changes the entire history of the city and the country. It's, of course, the stock market crash and the Great Depression. And so by the time the Gulf Building opens, I think in 1932, there's a story of him lonely walking along the observation deck on the 38th floor, you know, contemplating how things have gone so wrong because he's now hated at newsreels when they'd show him on the screen. The audience would boo and throw things at the screen. So he had to resign from his position as Secretary of the Treasury and, you know, spent the rest of remaining few years of his life defending his reputation. He was hauled before a federal investigation of his taxes for, you know, income tax fraud. And it was a rough last few years for Andrew Mellon.
So as the building is going up, his finances are going down?
Absolutely. And I think there's a funny finale to that story, or an interesting anyway. So in order to resurrect his reputation in some way, Mellon donates his art collection to the country and spends the money to build the National Gallery of Art on the Mall in Washington, D.C. as part of the Smithsonian. So it's his money and his art. He gives it to the country and he says, don't put my name on it, just call it the National Gallery. He's trying to set an example. And here in Pittsburgh, just a few months before he died in 1937, lo and behold, that 38th floor observation deck, which had been only open to, you know, Mellon's friends and, you know,
right,
people who had some important business with the Gulf Company, suddenly became open to the public and free. So for decades in Pittsburgh, I can't believe this, but until about 1970, you could just go to the roof of the Gulf Building and walk around on that observation deck. And when I wrote my column, I got a chance to walk on that deck, which is now not open to the public.
Right.
But I wish it were, because what a great view, what an exciting way to see the city.
Another building was associated with shaky, dare I say, shady finances. The German National Bank built a new structure in 1889 at the corner of 6th Avenue and Wood. But you say it closed like a decade later because of bankruptcy. Okay, that happens. But a city councilman offered to help out? How's a city councilman offering to save a building or save a company?
The German National Bank, which a lot of people know is the Granite Building, is next to the Duquesne Club on 6th, and it's this kind of craggy stone building. And as you say, within a decade, the bank had to close, but eventually it reopened. And the new bank president was William Ramsey. And in 1908, a city councilman, Joe Klein, came to Ramsey in his office and said, say, if you give me a campaign donation, let's call it, of $15,000, then I will invite your German National Bank to be one of the city depositories so that you'll get some overnight
infusion,
deposit business,
yeah.
and you know, there will be some interest to be made on that. So this is, you know, a nice lucrative extra side business for the bank for a bribe of $15,000. And it's said that the bank president took the money out of the safe and placed it on his desk in a shoebox, and then he and the cashier left the room. And when they returned, the councilman was gone, and so was the $15,000. This councilman, though, was so pleased with himself that apparently he was telling everyone about how much money he'd just made with the bribe. And it got back to the city solicitor. And eventually, there was a trial about this. It actually peeled back the layer to see that of the 155 people that were then...
Hold it. 155 people on council?
Yes. Of the 155 councilmen, 98 of them were indicted for accepting bribes. So this,
not just from this bank.
Well, other, not just from things. The German National Bank,
yes,
but from other banks and from other places and other graft scandals. But this was the tip of the iceberg. What happened in the German National Bank started an investigation at the city council that revealed this level of corruption that eventually caused city council to be chopped down from 155 members to 9, as it is today.
Mark Hauser is a columnist for Pittsburgh Magazine. He's an historian, and he is the director of news and information at Robert Morris University. He will share his impressions of the Foster House, Gulf Tower, German National Bank, and more at the Landmarks Preservation Resource Center in Wilkinsburg Thursday evening at 6. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Kevin, it's been a pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, calls for investment in infrastructure, nothing new. President Trump mentioned it in his February State of the Union address. But what about digital infrastructure? A conversation on what it'll take to close America's rural-urban divide. If you missed anything from today's program, or you want to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcast. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Joe Yazenkovich, and Alex Linnigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.